Gentlemen, thank you for standing by. Today's call is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. All participants will be in a listen-only mode for the duration of the call. During the question and answer session, if you would like to ask a question, please press star one. I would now like to turn the call over to Keely Leva. You may begin.
Hi, everyone. This is Keely Belva from NOAA Communications. Thanks for joining us today. As the operator said, this call is being recorded, and we'll be able to make the audio available later today, and we'll post that on our website. So first off, let me explain where you can find the high tide flooding report that we'll be referencing. If you go to noaa.gov, the website, and then to the News and Features page, the story will be posted there. And if you have any trouble finding that link, we can also make sure that you get that separately following this call if you'd like. So I'm here today with two of our scientists, and I'd like to introduce them. They're the two of the scientists who authored the report. After they provide an overview, we'll take some questions from the media. First off, we'll start with Dr. Gregory Dusek, and Greg is the senior scientist for NOAA's Center for Operational Oceanographic Products and Services. Then you'll hear from Dr. William Sweet. Billy's an oceanographer with NOAA's Center for Operational Oceanographic Products and Services, and he's the report's lead author. So Greg, if you can start us off, that'd be great.
All right. Thank you, Keely, and thanks everyone for joining us. So I wanted to just quickly provide a little bit of background regarding the water level data that was used for this work for those who might not be aware. And so our office at NOAA runs the National Water Level Observation Network, which is a network of over 210 real-time, long-term, continuously operating water level gauges or tide gauges across the U.S. Many of our gauges have been operating since the early 1900s, and several of them have data records exceeding 100 years of data. Now, with the data from the network, we have real-time data, which comes in every 6 minutes. We also have tide predictions, and things like that are utilized to support a range of activities, including safe and marine navigation. But because we also have these long-term data records, which I mentioned are continuous and high quality, we're able to track and provide information on things like sea level rise, like high tide flooding, and how those are changing across the U.S. and changing in time. And so that data is what enabled the report that we're going to be talking about today, which is the 2017 State of the U.S. High Tide Flooding with a 2018 Outlook. And so this report, in this report, we're assessing the number of days of high tide flooding across the U.S. In 2017 and then providing an outlook for 2018. I think it's important just to make sure everyone's aware that we're talking about the meteorological year in the report. And so the data from 2017 covers from May of 2017 to April of 2018. And then in 2018, we're talking about May of 2018 to April of 2019. Now, this is the fourth year that we've done this type of outlook, but there's a little bit of a difference this year, and the big one is that we are able to cover a broader geographic scope. So in previous years, we were only looking at 28 of our gauges across the U.S., and now we're able to do this same type of analysis for 98 gauges, so covering a much broader area. And the methods behind this and the reason we're able to utilize all those gauges is covered in a recent tech report that we published, which you may be aware of. You can find it on our website. It was published in 2018, and it's the patterns and projections of high tide flooding along the U.S. coastline using a common impact threshold. And so in there, we describe how we're able to look at all of these different locations and then how we have changed our thresholds for indicating when a high tide flood occurs. And Billy will get into that in a little bit more detail. And so in this report, the reason that we're doing it is really twofold. One is to track changes in high tide flooding over time throughout the U.S., and as you can see, in some cases, there's been a fairly rapid increase. And then also to provide coastal communities with information about what to potentially expect in their locations in the coming year. In addition to this report, we combine this information with our high tide bulletin, which you might be aware of. It's available online, and the bulletin is released every season and provides information about what days in certain regions you might expect high tide flooding to occur, when the tides are likely to be the highest. And we just released our summer bulletin, and so you can find that up on the site where we provide what days across the regions throughout the U.S. are likely to see high tide flooding, or most likely to see that high tide flooding in June, July, and August. And so before handing it over to Billy, I just wanted to finish up with a quick story, which I think highlights why having these long-term data records is so important and how we can really, you know, track how high tide flooding is changing over time. I'm going to use Charleston, South Carolina, as my example, where we've had a water level gauge operating relatively continuously since 1921. And in Charleston in 1928, they were hit by the Lake Okeechobee hurricane, which was a Category 4 storm when it barreled through Florida. It was one of the deadliest hurricanes in U.S. history, and by the time it hit Charleston, it dropped to a Category 1 storm, but it still caused significant damage and flooding. And our tide gauge measured the flooding associated with the storm, and it measured an elevation of 0.57 meters above mean high or high water. And the importance of that number is that value is now the high tide flooding threshold that we're using to indicate whether flooding is occurring at Charleston. And that value, that 0.57 meters above mean high or high water, was the highest observed water level at our gauge from 1921, when the gauge was installed, to 1934. So over 14 years, that was the highest water level observed. Now, fast forward to last year, where we exceeded that value four times in Charleston, and we're projected to exceed it at least four times again this year. And so my point with this is, you know, by looking at this long-term data record, we can see how the flooding that used to only occur during major storms and maybe once in a decade now occurs with regularity, you know, four or five times a year. So with that, I'm going to pass it on to Billy, who's going to talk about the report in a little more detail.
Great. Hi, everybody. So let's do the numbers. So we'll look back at 2017. 2017 was a record breaker. The U.S. average high tide flood frequency, or the number of days per year with high tide flooding, hit an historical record. More than a quarter of the locations also tied or broke their individual records as well. Regionally, high tide flooding in 2017 was most prevalent on the Northeast Atlantic and the Western Gulf of Mexico. This was primarily in response to an active nor'easter and hurricane season, as well as continued sea level rise, which caused the lesser extreme events to become more impactful, similar as to what Greg had just mentioned. A few of the sort of the highest overall cities that in terms of the number of days with high tide flooding or their annual flood frequency for 2017 that broke or tied the records include Boston, Massachusetts, Atlantic City, New Jersey, Sandy Hook, New Jersey, Sabine Pass, Texas, and Galveston, Texas. We have a list of the other upwards of 28 or so in the actual tech report highlighted in red, so you can actually go by if there's a particular region that of interest, you can get that information. I think the underlying trend is quite clear. Due to sea level rise, the national average trend in high tide flood frequency is now more than 50% higher than it was 20 years ago and 100% higher than it was 30 years ago. Along most of the U.S. East Coast, a troublesome trend continues. Due to sea level rise, the annual number of days of high tide flooding is increasing at an accelerated rate. In particular, the Southeast Atlantic coast, sort of Norfolk southward, is experiencing the fastest rate of increase in flooding, more than 150% increase since 2000 alone. Now, more common high tides and wind events are causing street level flooding. The problem is once impacts become noticeable or problematic, they'll become chronic rather quickly. So in reviewing, for some of you that may or may not be totally aware of some of the background, you know, sea level is rising. Globally, it's upwards of 3 millimeters a year or so or more, which equates to about an inch every 8 years. About one-third of that rise is due to thermal expansion of the ocean as the oceans take in the heat. And about two-thirds or so is coming from land-based ice melt. That's a departure of the trends that we've witnessed over the last 100 and some years, almost double. So in the last 25 years, it's double the rate that we've been seeing the previous century. In the future, sea levels are expected to increase and actually increase more so. So, let's look at 2018. Records are expected to continue to be broken, though there will be regional variability and there will be weather patterns that are going to be hard to be predict. But due to increases in sea level, again, the records are expected. Where? We'll see. And El Nino is possible during late 2018 into 2019. It's not officially predicted to occur by NOAA, but the multimodal ensemble suggests that conditions are favorable for its development. Typically, when El Nino develops, you have higher flood frequencies in about half of the U.S. locations that we examine, primarily along the west and east coasts. Typically, during an El Nino, you have warmer ocean water and higher sea levels for months at a time along the west coast during the winter season. Along the east coast, we typically have more wind events, either prevailing winds, northerly winds that cause waters to pile up, or just overall wind events, nor'easters, that track along the U.S. coastline. As a whole, flood frequencies during 2018 are predicted to be upwards of about 60% higher across U.S. coastlines as compared to a baseline, in this case, of about 20 years ago or year 2000. Along the northeast Atlantic and the northwest Pacific, sort of these northern latitudes where you tend to have steeper topography, which oftentimes will buffer the extent of impacts, you tend to get more storms in these parts of the country. 5 to 6 days or so are predicted, median value across the stations, and that represents about 100% increase in the Atlantic, Northeast Atlantic, and only about a 10% increase or so in the Northwest Pacific relative to that 2000-year baseline. Along the flatter and more vulnerable Southeast Atlantic and Gulf Coasts, 2 to 3 days are expected in 2018, and that would represent a 160 and a 50% increase since 2000, respectively. So El Nino is expected to have sort of a bump up in primarily these east and west coasts, not so much the Gulf Coast. Historically, effects of El Nino, La Nina, both the flip side, aren't as well documented, at least statistically, as being a problem there. Along the southwest Pacific coast, about 2 days of high tiding or so are predicted, which would represent about a 70% increase. So something that might have happened maybe once a day or maybe once or twice every few years, 20 years ago. Now we're expecting about twice that. Little or no tidal flooding is expected along the islands of the U.S., the Caribbean, Hawaii, the U.S. Pacific Islands. Kwajalein Islands an exception. Again, in all cases, we're measuring and assessing this flooding using tide gauges, which really don't capture wave effects or rainfall. So in the Pacific Islands and Hawaii and elsewhere, oftentimes you have large swell that can actually couple with king tides and cause actually overwash and flood areas like Honolulu that we saw last summer. So that's sort of the numbers. Again, you know, what's happened, sort of keeping a pulse on, you know, how things are changing and giving this outlook for next year to help communities become better prepared and anticipate what's very possible to occur to assist in their planning. The response associated with high tide flooding oftentimes is closing of streets, installing of temporary measures like sandbags, inflow preventers, pumps. So there's a cost, and it's important for communities to know what to expect, and that's why we're doing this. As Greg mentioned, we're sort of assessing using an expanded set of stations. In all cases, the elevation as to which we're assessing this type of flooding, which is typically more disruptive, but sometimes it's damaging, is somewhere between 1.5 and maybe a little bit over 2 feet above the typical high tide. Again, at this height, oftentimes water is sort of overwhelmed stormwater systems. Infiltration is an issue, which affects sort of wastewater and stormwater systems. Some properties and infrastructure will also experience flooding. So in essence, this expanded set of indicators are sort of informed by local officials on the ground that recognize that, you know, what height do impacts actually occur. But we've sort of expanded this on a national set, and really one motivation is to provide a sort of a consistent flood threshold as a tangible indicator of sea level rise. that's consistent in the types of impacts that it creates. Largely before doing this, and in the years past similarly, it was important because people really didn't know what to look for in terms of sea level rise. And now they do, and it has impacts, and it's important for better recognition of that and to what to expect in the coming year. So with that, we'll pause and take questions.
Great. This is Keely Belva again. I just want to, again, mention where folks on the phone can find the report. Our site was being updated as we've been talking. So if you go to NOAA.gov, you'll see the first, you'll see a link under, it's the first link under Around NOAA. So if you scroll about halfway down, then you'll be able to get to our web story and be able to link to the report from there. The numbers that, the data that Billy was just talking about are on page 12. They start at page 12.
11 and 12
of the report, so you can find the list there. Operator, can you explain again how folks can ask questions, and then we'll be able to start taking your questions here in just a couple of minutes.
Absolutely. At this time, if you would like to ask a question, please press star 1 from your phone, unmute your line, and record your first and your last name clearly when prompted. One moment as we wait for the first question. Yeah, our first question comes from Craig Miller from KQED. Your line is open.
Hi, thanks very much. Bill, a couple of things. First of all, you were moving through some of those numbers pretty fast, and I couldn't quite keep up. At the top, you mentioned, you referenced a 50% increase over some point and a 100% increase over some point in time. Could you just reiterate that if you remember what that was? And also, can you talk to some of the potential hotspots on the West Coast where we have kind of a double whammy of both sea rise and land subsidence?
Sure. Yeah, I apologize. A lot of numbers, and again, you can piece through the report and get a lot of what I just said. But the numbers that I gave were using sort of a national average frequency. So in this case, we're looking at all the gauges that we assessed, upwards of 100. I guess it was 98 specifically. What was the average number of days with a high tide flood? And what we are seeing based on the trends, not cherry-picking one particular year, it's the underlying trend change. And this would be a figure 3 in the actual report if you go to it. On average, based upon the change in trends, we're seeing that a 50% increase compared to 20 years ago, and a 100% increase compared to 30 years ago.
Okay.
So that's what that statistic was. And in terms of the West Coast, as you mentioned, where you do have some tectonics, where you do have some land motion, and where might some of the hot spots, there was a record broken in San Diego, California, last year with 13 days. The historical record was 9. So sort of your Southern California area, particularly in San Diego, really received, experienced the most. Up in the Northwest Pacific, you know, in most of this whole West Coast over the last several decades, not so much in the last few years, sea level trends have not been as high as they historically have been, though that rate has been picking up in the last 4 or 5 years with a switch in a larger scale ocean phenomenon called the Pacific Decadal Oscillation. But for the most part, the Northwest Pacific is a very active area, but we haven't been seeing a very active increase in trends. Typically, you have a handful each year in these locations, but the overall rate increase is not as great. But in terms of, you know, what used to be fairly uncommon is now becoming increasingly common. You really sort of look to sort of the Southern California region right now as an area that's experiencing larger increases.
And that San Diego record you said was in met year 17-18?
That's correct.
Okay. Thanks very much.
Can we get the next question, please?
Thank you. Our next question comes from Brian Sullivan from Bloomberg News. Your line is open.
Hi, thanks. You mentioned that in the Northeast you had 5 to 6 days of higher normal tides. What What do you exactly mean by that? How much over were they? And also, if you could do the hot spots for the Northeast as well, I'd appreciate it.
Sure. So that 5 to 6 days was sort of a median, kind of gives more of a broad stroke regionally for the Northeast Atlantic, and that was predicted for this coming 2018. But in terms of what was experienced in 2017, some of these record-breaking areas really extend all the way up to Boston, as I mentioned, and southwards all the way down to more or less just north of the Chesapeake Bay. So, for instance, areas such as Newport and Providence, Rhode Island, New London and Bridgeport, Connecticut, the Battery, Bergen Point, Sandy Hook, Atlantic City, Lewis, Delaware. So these are areas in 2017 that really sort of took the brunt of a lot of these nor'easters, as well as, again, in these areas in the mid-Atlantic from, you know, south of New York to basically the Chesapeake Bay region, relatively high rates of sea level rise, 3, 4, 5 millimeters a year rise in some of these locations, which, you know, can get up to an inch every 6 years. So, again, maybe a less salient factor, but is ever, you know, increasing through time. The reach of just lesser storms or just typical winds are also contributing some of these record-breaking numbers that we're experiencing. And so in terms of hot spots, let's say, that pretty much covers it. I think up and down those that area, you know, we're seeing large increases compared to, let's say, 20 years ago or so, upwards of 100% increase.
Who was speaking? I'm sorry.
Sorry, that was William Sweet.
Okay.
Great. I think we're ready for the next question.
Thank you. As a reminder, if you would like to ask a question, please press star 1 from your phone, unmute your line, and record your first and your last name clearly when prompted. Our next question comes from Nicholas Kuznets from Inside Climate News. Your line is open.
Hi, thanks. I'm wondering if you can explain a little bit behind how the total relative days of flooding are relatively lower in the Southeast at the same time that region is experiencing the highest, I believe, rate of increase. So, you know, what's behind those two things?
Sure. This is William Sweet talking. So, as we all sort of know anecdotally, it gets pretty busy up there in the wintertime in the Northeast. It's, you know, loosely, that's why a lot of people sort of head south. You know, it's like, man, those are tough winters there and tough falls, and it's very windy. So you tend to have more energetic system oftentimes, you know, in the Northeast Atlantic compared to the Southeast Atlantic. Besides the rare hurricane that may come by, it's pretty calm in the south. And so, again, water moves not only due to tides, which is very predictable, but due to oftentimes winds that blow, and it's just more active there. So you're going to have higher overall numbers in the Northeast than you would in the Southeast. So your question, and the second part of the question, is the rate increase. And so the rate increase, let's say in the South, if you goes from, let's say, 1 to 3 days, you know, that's a 200% increase compared to if you went from 6 to 9 days, it's a 50% increase. It may not seem like much, you know, it may be, you know, well, that's statistics speaking, but again, the Northeast is steeper, usually, typically less land exposed, and so it's these change in flood frequency oftentimes that really becomes noticeable and impacting, because it's not typically the way that infrastructure was laid and used, you know, that was contemporary for its time. So that's why we're seeing a larger rate increase in the Southeast compared to the Northeast. And, you know, again, there's the problem with that is once impacts become noticeable, there typically is not much difference between, if you look in within a year at the daily, the typical spread of 365 days in a year, if it's a calm location, there's not much difference oftentimes. The tide range could be large, and that might impart a little bit of difference depending if you're a full moon or you know, spring tide or neap tide. But, you're very close in. So with a little bit of sea level rise, you can really get a big jump in the number of days that become impacting compared to somewhere in the Northeast where you can have a very large spread. Big storms, no storms, sometimes storms. With continued sea level rise, you can have increases, and you can already have a overall large number of relatively larger number of events now. But with increases in sea level, you don't have as rapid increase in overall number of days.
I see. Thanks.
Thank you. Next question, please.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Tamara Dietrich from the Daily Press, Newport News, Virginia. Your line is open.
Thank you. Well, as mentioned, we are in the Norfolk, Virginia, Hampton Roads region of Virginia, and we have been described as having the second highest rate of sea level rise in the country outside of Louisiana. But in the report that I read, and also some, as was mentioned today, we are either in the Northeast Atlantic or the Southeast Atlantic region, and so it's just unclear to me what, you know, our region experienced in 2017 and can expect in 2018. So I just wonder if you could perhaps clarify just a little bit where Norfolk, Virginia, or the Hampton Roads region stands in terms of your report and what we can expect.
Sure. This is William Sweet again. Yeah, there are certain areas that sort of straddle regions. And again, these regions are, you know, not necessarily, you know, definitive in terms of, yeah, a line in the sand. You're now in the north or you're now in the south. But typically you have different types of exposure when you get sort of north of Cape Hatteras, North Carolina versus south of Cape Hatteras. So it's sort of on a mix. But in the end, it's really important as to what is expected more locally. Sometimes these regional numbers are better to assess sort of broad stroke, but when it comes down to it, what's actually happening in your community. So Norfolk does get the effects of both the types of wind patterns that oftentimes affects the Northeast Atlantic, but it also is very close to the Gulf Stream, which also imparts in a effect on sea levels, as well as the Chesapeake Bay due to the alignment of the bay and oftentimes different winds. Last year, Norfolk area experienced, as measured by the Sewell's Point gauge, experienced 14 days of high tide flooding. Its record was 15, so it was very close. And I know that particular part of the country well, and I know you definitely have a lot of these sunny day floods that are, you know, increasingly becoming problematic. So in terms of next year, the outlook, we're somewhere around 11 days. And this particular part of the country is in the mid-Atlantic is usually sensitive to the development of El Nino. So if an El Nino does form, historically, you will have higher than expected number of days with high tide flooding.
Thank you. Do we have any more questions?
At this time, there are no other questions over the phone. As a reminder, if you would like to ask a question, please press star 1 from your phone, unmute your line, and record your first and your last name clearly when prompted. One moment as we wait for any additional questions. One moment. Okay, our next question comes from Brian Sullivan from Bloomberg News. Your line is open.
Hi, I just wanted to get clear. What exactly do you mean 5 to 6 days of flooding? Is it storm related? Is it sunny day flooding? What exactly are we talking about here?
Good question. So in our assessment, we assess water levels that reach or exceed the threshold, the nationally consistent sort of threshold that I was referring to. And then, so in the Northeast, it's somewhere about 1 3/4 feet, maybe upwards to 2 feet above high tide. You know, this could also include things that are, you know, very extensive flooding. You know, a strong nor'easter, for instance, that Boston experienced and much of the Northeast experienced this past January and February and March. But so it's a makeup. It's a makeup of higher than normal high tides. That might be due to prevailing winds offshore that are causing a little higher than normal water levels, and your seasonal highest astronomic tide occurs and causes flooding, sunny day flooding, like you'll get in Norfolk and Atlantic City, areas in New York City, Jamaica Bay area. But it could also include any wind events as well. So the outlooks are really based upon a continuation of the historical trend. And what hasn't really changed is the fact that you will oftentimes have several nor'easters during the winter, and you will have seasonally highest tides that occur during the Earth, Moon, Sun system. But what is changing is sea level. As it gets higher, more and more events become increasingly impacted. So that makeup of the 5 to 6 or so on median really will capture any water level above that threshold in response to several different processes that aren't necessarily unique for that year, but that sea level rise is causing them to reach higher levels.
And this is Greg Dusek. And just to add an example of, you know, what does it look like, you know, how much flooding are you going to get when you hit one of these thresholds? And that's going to be location dependent, but an example is up on the NOAA site now with the web story from Annapolis, Maryland, back in this past October during the boat show there, where the water levels at that gauge hit exactly the flood threshold we're using. And you can see, you know, there's a fairly decent amount of water in the streets, you know, running up to shops and things like that. So it kind of paints a picture of, at least for Annapolis and some other areas, kind of what type of flooding, kind of minimum type of flooding you'd expect with these type of with these threshold values.
And this is William. One last follow-up to it. As in anything, the big things occur less often than the smaller things. So in this case, if we're talking about flood depth, so it's sort of like a normal distribution or Gaussian, so the larger things are rare. So typically when we give outlooks, they're usually weighted towards the smaller types of floods. That would be closer to the threshold or maybe a little bit above compared to the record-smashing high event of a strong nor'easter might count, but you wouldn't expect the makeup to be dominated by those types of events.
Great. Next question, please.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Craig Miller from KQED. Your line is open.
Okay, thanks again. Well, you know, here in San Francisco Bay, we just had sort of a breakthrough local measure where people in Foster City voted to tax themselves to gird against sea level rise, you know, and heighten and strengthen their levee. I'm just curious, do you have, obviously, some of the numbers you have speak to an increase in frequency of flooding. Looking kind of backwards, do you have any projections on this and the accelerated, how the rate of flooding might accelerate in places like San Francisco Bay?
Yes, this is William. As Greg mentioned earlier, that we did have a report come out 2 months ago, Patterns and Projections of High Tide Flooding, where we actually put into perspective the numbers that we're talking about here, the 2017, what happened, and what may very well happen in 2018. We put that into perspective of future sea level rise scenarios for the United States. A year and a half ago, we put out a report that really gave, sort of framed, you know, what might global sea level rise look like this century. It could be as high as this or as low as this, and we have 6 different scenarios. And then we downscaled those scenarios locally for, you know, what's land subsidence doing? How might ocean circulation change, like the Gulf Stream? If it slows down, you have higher sea levels on the East Coast, along the West Coast and East Coast. Where ice melts matters. If we get a lot of ice melt in Antarctica, the gravitational attraction of that huge amount of ice that's there will lessen and water will go elsewhere, and it will exacerbate the overall amount of rise that you would experience, you know, throughout much of the U.S. and Antarctica's case. So we actually give projections at these thresholds moving forward. And we actually overlay, you know, what's happened historically to these six scenarios at a location. So communities can kind of get a sense of sort of what trajectory they seem to be following and what their outcomes could be by decade throughout the rest of the century.
Okay, so I could find something local in that in that report from, what did you say?
It's a 2018 report, and there's an accompanying data set, and if you would like to contact.
Yeah, Craig, it's Keely Belva. I can send it to you, or you can email me at Keely, K-E-E-L-E-Y, dot Belva, B as in boy, E.
Yeah, I got your email. Thank you.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you. As a reminder, if you would like to ask a question, please press star 1 from your phone, unmute your line, and record your first and your last name clearly when prompted. One moment as we wait for additional questions. And we did have a question from Thomas Vaught. It looks like your line was removed from queue. If you can, please press star 1 so that way we can queue your question. Thank you.
While we're waiting, this is Keely again. Just one more time, you can find the report if you go to NOAA.gov, and then it's the first bullet under around NOAA right from the homepage, and there's a web story there, and then you can find the report linked in that story. You can also email Diana Parker or myself if you have any questions. We're happy to connect you with some of the resources we have available as well.
Thank you. We do have a question from Thomas Vaught from Anna Maria Island Sun. Your line is open.
Thank you. Anna Maria Island is in the Gulf Coast, south of Tampa and north of Sarasota. And we're about 6 to 8 inches sea level, above sea level, and we are experiencing regular flooding in a lot of the swales. What should governments be doing as far as building codes along the coast?
This is William. Well, we obviously we don't really speak to policy decisions and tell communities, you know, how to plan. But what we do provide is this sort of information based upon the long-term records that we have and the very localized records that we have, that really hopefully speak to the types of impacts communities are seeing and how those impacts have been changing through time, as well as the last question as to what may occur next season, as well what might happen several decades from now, and giving that kind of continuum of information based on what's already happened, what's likely to happen, which to what may occur, so that smart decisions can be made using the best available data at their disposal.
Okay, thank you.
All right.
Thank you. There are no other questions in queue at this time.
Okay. Well, then I think we will wrap up. Again, this audio will be made available as soon as we can later today. We'll put it up on the NOAA website, and you're welcome to email or contact Diana Parker or Keely Belva if you have any further questions. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for your participation in today's conference. You may disconnect at this time.